Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey friends, welcome to the Tennis and Bagels podcast. My name is Andre, and this is the first time in 2022 that the trio is back together. Like, Function and Owen have already recorded an episode about the whole Djokovic saga last week, so we're not going to be chatting about this week, especially because it's still in the middle of everything. Like, there's not much certainty still, like, about you know, whether he's going to play, whether he's even going to stay in Australia. There is other things that are also like entering the chat when it comes to this, like other countries and whatever. We're not really down here for this today. We're just going to be a refreshingly good old tennis talk about tactics and good shots and good names that are doing well. And of course, the ATP Cup, because I'm Canadian and Canada just won. And that's amazing. So yeah, how are you guys doing?
Doing well. It's really nice to have the trio sort of back together, you know, Owen and I, when we did that episode. A lot has happened in the last 1 week, and some of those things have really just not relevant anymore. And, you know, we're still in the midst of all of this, and the draw for the Australian Open is supposed to come out in about 4 hours, you know, as we're recording this, and we're still not sure what's going to happen. But, you know, despite all the tumultuous road to the Australian Open starting so far, like, there's been some amazing tennis. So I'm really happy to sit here and chat about everything that's gone on the court. So
yeah. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but personally, I'm just devastated that we're not going to be breaking down like immigration laws and COVID protocol, because I really think Djokovic is like the hottest, most fun topic in tennis right now. No, I'm totally kidding. That I couldn't be more tired of that story, and I'm really excited to talk about on court tennis. So yeah, let's get into it.
Yep. And this is what we're here for, rather than the epidemiology and lawyer.
Epidemiology. Immigration and bagels or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I was I don't know about you guys, but I watched the trial for like a couple minutes, and I was like, I don't know what is going on. I think like one of the lawyers like, please turn to section like ALQXB1752. I'm like, okay, that's it. I'm tapping out of this.
Those sure. things are good that they turned them live, but it's not for everyone. Like it's not entertainment. Like, let's just put it that way.
I think on my dad, why I didn't go to law school.
So. Right. I think on Microsoft Teams as well, they forgot to like mute everyone. And so fans like took it over at one point and started like blasting music before it started.
Is it like as if it's a tennis match and the DJ is like, it's like, imagine the tunnel walk, just Djokovic entering the court. It's like, oh God. My gosh.
Although his on-court walk at remember the Paris Masters with Medvedev in the final?
Yeah,
that was a really cool on-court walk. It was like flashy and they had a bunch of lights.
I know Paris is great, like, for all the crap that we give them like before the end of the year, because it's like, oh, this shouldn't even be a Masters in 1000.
Yeah,
they do a great job.
I mean, they do. I mean, like, every time I write about Roland Garros, I always write like in Paris. I'm like, wait, there's another tournament there.
In the Paris Grand Slam.
Yeah.
Right. Major, rather, because if you write grins, then people are gonna rip you apart for using the wrong term, apparently. So yeah, like, as a Grand Slam is approaching, in fact, we had a really good week last week for Canadians. Felix Auger-Aliassime and then Shapovalov, double-handedly, or for Shapo, single-handedly, backhandedly, won the ATP Cup for Canada, and I watched most of their matches, if not all of them. So it was really fun to watch. Did you guys catch a little bit of that?
Yeah, I caught bits and pieces. I'll start with Shapo. Shapo was, I mean, there was so much uncertainty surrounding Team Canada, right? Because Shapo, obviously, he had tested positive for COVID, and, you know, he hadn't got much training and practice time in. And those are the two stars of the team, Felix and Dennis. And, you know, Dennis came out a very tricky first round opponent, right, against Dan Evans, you know, somebody who's a foil for a lot of top players. And, you know, definitely no shame in losing that one. But then he had three excellent victories in the singles, I thought, you know, beating Struff, who's a player that he's, you know, sort of had his, Struff has had his number against him, and they've had some close matches, but they haven't gone Chapeau's way. So for Chapeau to come through that one in three sets, I thought was pretty impressive. And he played some bold tennis, some courageous tennis on big points. And then he had a really great win against Seffi Ullin in the semifinals, where there was quite a bit of pressure on Team Canada. And I actually remember watching that third set, and I watched him save those six break points, serving at 1-2 in the third set. That was just incredible courageous tennis by him. And because he was on the verge of sort of letting that match slip from his fingers, because he'd done so well to get himself to that point. And then for him to close that one out, and then the win that was the most impressive was in the final against PCB, you know, a player who's going to make you work and is not going to give you much. And I think their head-to-head going into that one, PCB had a 4-1 head-to-head. And so that was really, really impressive. And PCB came back at him in the second set, and he fought, and Chapeau just had all the goods. It was such a great match from him, like just start to finish. Really was one of the best performances I've seen from Chapeau in a big match, particularly in a final or semi.
So, it saved 8 of 9 break points.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, I was very impressed with Chapeau sort of in those last three matches that he played. What did you guys think about him?
I mean, yeah, like Andre is going to be the authority on this. I honestly didn't get to see too much of him, but I did watch highlights of the match against PCB. I was really impressed because, you know, PCB doesn't give anything for free. He had a big win over Chapeau at the US Open. Can't remember if it was 2019, I think.
2020.
Okay.
It was five.
Yeah, and that was a match that Chapeau really could have won, because I think he won the fourth set in a bagel, and PCB came back at him in the fifth. And it seems like since then, Chapeau has matured. He's learned how to kind of navigate the ups and downs of a match better. And I think that really showed in his big point play. It was closer than the score, 6-4, 6-3. But I thought Chapeau played a terrific match from the highlights. He looks pretty patient in the rallies while still maintaining that attacking mindset, which I think is the perfect balance for him. What do you think, Andre?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest points of development for Chapeau was necessarily he was being aggressive, but he was not like highlight reel aggressive all the time. You know what I mean? He was he played some shots that were like really hard hitting tennis, but they were like on big targets, and you know, he wasn't necessarily backing down, staying close to the line, just like, using the backhand, necessarily just trying to like rip like those backhand winners down the line. But he was also like hitting just powerful backhand cross court winners after building up a point, using his forehand most of the time. And he was hitting like nice big targets, and going cross court is mostly like a good bet because it's like a lower part of the net, and you just have like a little bit like longer, like a trajectory where the ball can go back inside of the court. And he was just hitting them very, very nicely against Dan Evans. You could see that he was trying, but he was just getting a little frustrated. And to be honest, major props for him for not getting overly frustrated in that match, because probably knew like, man, I'm not really doing good right now. But that's also because of COVID and the fact that he couldn't even practice before that match, really. So he really got it going. And I am excited to see like how he does like next against other players as well. And being in a pressure situation like Seffi Ullin and against PCB, I think it really shows that he can probably do this like on Grand Slams again. Like, I feel like this Chapeau could have taken that first set off of Djokovic and Wimbledon.
Yeah.
And maybe even like the second if he played like even better than that, because we all agree that Djokovic was not at his 100% best, and at Wimbledon he just managed to win because it's Djokovic. But
yeah.
Right.
Yep. And I thought Felix was also really impressive. Like, I was watching the highlights of his match against Batista Agut in the final. I was kind of amazed at what I was seeing. Like, the first set was 85 minutes. It was kind of back and forth, these really long rallies. We know how consistent RBA is. And Felix came through that and then ended up winning the second set sort of going away. He saved 10 of 11 break points, which means across the two matches with Chapeau and Felix, they saved, I think, 18 of 20 break points in total. That's outstanding. I think they both really managed to peak. And considering the pressure of playing with, you know, other players on your shoulders for your country, it's really impressive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just one thing I'd like to say about Chapeau, that I don't think I mentioned, is that, you know, his peak level is scary, scary good. Like, I mean, I think he has the potential to be such a frightening player. I mean, obviously, we can all agree, like, this is the best he's played since Wimbledon. I mean, mm-hmm. I also think, you know, he finished the year actually strong in his last tournament in Stockholm, where he almost won the title. He was really close against Tommy Paul in that Stockholm final. And, he, you know, Tommy Paul, like, played brilliantly in the last three games and took it away from him. I don't think Dennis actually lost that match, but which, you know, sometimes he kind of has a tendency sometimes to sort of beat himself because he goes for such, you know, such really big, bold shots. And so I think for him, it's just about like staying calm also mentally. And then also just, you know, constructing the points, like you were saying, Andre, you know, with this cross-court patterns and just sort of waiting for the right ball to attack. And I think he does, once he can figure out the pattern of constructing, you know, points with a reliable play, plays, because his back, for example, like his backhand in a rally can inject, he can inject quite a bit of offense and he can hit ridiculous angles, especially cross court with it. And his wide serve is such a can opening serve because it, you know, it pushes the opponent so far off the court. And then he just has a really nice sort of 1-2 combination. And then he's comfortable coming forward and, you know, maybe not always the best volleyer, but like when he gets up there and he always goes after it and he has the intent. So I feel like, and, you know, we've seen him against really big players sort of come close, but not quite do it. And, you know, this week, you know, when he was down, I feel like a lot of those matches, like especially the Safiulin match, I think that was a match he would have lost second half of last year. So that was really impressive for me. And the other thing about Felix that really impressed me is that he played three guys in the top 20 this week. And then all three of those guys are consistent baseliners who don't miss much. Like he played Cameron Norrie, he played Batista Agut in the final, he played Zverev. And all three of those matches, all of the rallies that went over 9+ shots, I mean, he was dictating, he was outlasting his opponents, like in these long, long exchanges. And you don't normally, you know, associate, sometimes the criticism for Felix is sometimes like a shot selection or sometimes just, you know, kind of gets a little impatient, pulls the trigger a little bit too early. But I feel like he was really playing a sort of measured offense this week. And he was really like, the heaviness of his shots really came through, especially against Norrie and against RBA. I mean, he had to hit like, I think I saw a tweet from Gil Gross that he had to hit like, it felt like 60,000 forehands to sort of break him, to sort of break RBA down because he's so consistent from the baseline and he doesn't miss at all. And even the loss that he had against Fritz, I thought was very encouraging because Fritz is playing like a top 20 player right now. And that was the first match of the year against, against a guy who's been pretty hot since the US Open. And he lost that in three sets. And, you know, even the match against Medvedev, it was quite close for a while. And then Medvedev sort of ran away with it, but it was a really, really encouraging week for Felix, and he's now up to 9 in the world. And he's, for me, he was probably the standout MVP like of this week. And I find it hard to believe that this won't be like a big step forward for him just in terms of his career. I feel like the first title is coming really soon.
I would agree with that. I think something he can maybe work on is against like the best players, maybe not fading towards the end of the match like he did against Medvedev. But I think, I mean, really, like, the next step for him is getting a really big breakout win. Like, I don't think he needs to win a title to prove that he's a great player. Like, he's, like we've been saying, he's 9 in the world. His game has been firing on all cylinders. He's got a very high ceiling. He's been going deep in majors. I think all that's, like, what's next for him, really, is to beat a top 3 player in, like, a late round of a major. And then that's going to be his big breakthrough. Because he's kind of done everything else besides that. Like, I don't think a title is necessary to solidify his confidence at this point.
Yeah. He's in a good position against Zverev, right? Because he's a top 10 player. Yeah. So that means that Zverev's going to lose to him in a major.
The win against Zverev at Wimbledon was huge for him. You know, because until then, he hadn't had sort of a top 10 win. And then making the semis of the US Open. I mean, that match against Tiafo. I mean, he's really coming through now in, like, big moments, like in big spots.
That match against Tiafoe was really similar to the one he played against Berrettini at Wimbledon, where, you know, they split sets and then the third was really tight. And at Wimbledon, he lost that match, and then at the US Open, he won it. That was really impressive to see. I think he's been on a pretty steady improvement curve, and I think it's going to continue.
Mm-hmm. I also just realized
one more thing.
Yeah,
this is not quite that important, but I realized, like, it was Spain versus Canada in the Davis Cup final, right, in 2019.
Yeah.
And I remember he had lost that match to RBA, and that was a tight first set, and then he sort of almost went away, like, sort of in the second set, and was like decisive for RBA, like 7-6, 6-3, and this time it was exactly flipped the other way around. And so that shows the progress, like, full circle for Felix in the last couple of years. Just something I wanted to point out.
Yeah, I think this is just really classic Felix in the sense, like, it just very consistently progressing. Like, he's in a very steady, like, upwards curve. Like, as in, at some point, like, during the stream, I was getting kind of upset because there was a guy who was really trying to talk about, like, how Felix he's like 21, he should be like winning majors by now and whatever. And there was a guy who's like, yeah, but like he's still very young. Like, there's a lot of things to learn. And he was talking about his shot selection, which, yes, can be iffy at times, but like this week it probably happened like one or two times at best. Maybe in the end of the match at the second set against Zverev, that's kind of like where he kind of reverted a little bit backwards, but like he kind of picked himself up and won the match. But then, like, it was the commentator was comparing him to Nadal winning Roland Garros at 18 years old. I was like, man, you don't just compare people to Nadal unless they're named Federer and Djokovic. Like, it's just not a thing that you do. It's like, come on, like, pick a better player to do that comparison. Let's compare him to, I don't know, even his own compatriot like Shapovalov, or you can even compare him to like maybe Zverev or Medvedev, or like closer to like what he is. Like, obviously, Zverev has won a couple big titles already, but Medvedev took him a while to actually like click.
Took him a long time, and for a lot of the time, you know, he wasn't even hyped. I remember, you know, there were other guys sort of ahead of him, like Zverev and Tsitsipas, who were more hyped than him. And then, you know, he eventually made his breakthrough, and he's like, what, 25 now, and he's finally won a major, like 25 and a half. For a 21-year-old, Felix is 21. I mean, Chapo is only 22, and sometimes it's so easy to forget because they broke through when they were so young. Like Chapo with his breakthrough in 2017. I mean, he was just he was just a teenager.
He's like, a baby.
And to make 8 finals, you know, and on all 3 surfaces at a 500, 250 level, he's now made like quarters, semis, and majors. Like, he's been consistent there. And like, you know, not many teenagers have done that, even like even Roger Federer, right? Like, after he beat Pete Sampras in the 2001 Wimbledon.
Yeah, it took him another 2 years.
Yeah, it didn't really do much after that.
Yeah.
I don't think he even won a title in 2001, right? It was in 2002 only. Beginning.
Right. I mean, January. 2002, he wins a Masters and he finishes in the top 10. But like, I mean, it took him two full solid years.
I mean, the reality is, on the ATP, 25 is the new 20. Like, players are not breaking out in their late teens or early 20s anymore, because you have these legends hanging around. It takes time to get physically fit enough to dominate in best of five. And maybe that'll change when, you know, Djokovic finally ages out and we revert to more mortal champions. But for right now, at least, like, it's just not happening. You need an immense amount of talent and an immense amount of endurance to break through really young. And so I think everyone needs to sort of readjust their expectations and make new comparisons, because, you know, like with Medvedev and team, who are the most recent non-big three guys to win a major in this era, both happened for them very late. Kind of like you alluded to, Vaughn, like Medvedev was around for a while before he started to do amazing things. Kind of same thing for team. I think people were maybe taking note of him as early as 2014, but like, what did he do that year? Nothing. Like, even in 2016, when he made his first major semifinal, he lost to Djokovic really comfortably. It was a couple of years after that before he started to actually feel like a threat to win majors. So I think with these guys, the right thing to do is give them time, because they are improving, but it just takes a lot to finally get to the level you need to be at to win a major. Yeah.
And for Felix specifically, like, game wise this week, I think one of the things that improved immensely for him, because the forehand has always been really a strength in his game, the serve has been good, hasn't been double faulting much, which is very, very encouraging. He was capable of like using different sorts of paces as well in his second serve, but his backhand was just solid. Like, and I didn't normally see much of his backhand. Like, last year, I thought his slice backhand was better than his topspin one. But this year, like, I feel like he's definitely used the angles so much better. He wasn't going down the line with the backhand, which he used to do a few times, which was a little kind of like a barometer of like where his confidence and not is during a match. Because if he starts going too much too soon of the backhand side, like, then, you know, like, oh yeah, you got it. Like, you got him. That's how Evans actually beat him in Melbourne final. Like, you could see that Felix was just going for the backhand down the line, wasn't working, was missing. But this year he just kept going with the rallies. He just kept extending it. Like, he didn't get his shot he wanted. He kept going. He kept like pushing, and finally he got the forehand, or like got a good backhand that he needed, or a drop shot, and which was really good. Like, his shot selection was great, and specifically against Zverev. And I am pretty sure that this is 100% Tony Nadal's influence in his game. Loopy backhands were abundant in that match, and I was like, what is happening? Am I watching, like, this is like Nadal came in, like, was coaching Felix at that moment. It's like, just neutralizing Zverev serve, like, with a high backhand, like, when he was serving to the backhand, just going straight down the middle, like, no pace, this loopy backhand, and that's it. That rally starts now, and that was it. Like, no serve advantage for Zverev, and that was really just great to see. It's like, just the on-court awareness and just the pace awareness of, like, you know, like, what to do, like, how to actually play a shot, which is not going to be a winner, but it's going to put you in a better position in a rally, right? So
yeah, that's a really good analysis, actually. And, yeah. And you know what I think is that he has such a heavy ball, like, on the forehand, that he can get so many short balls.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like he's a player who perfectly understands, like, with his depth and with his, like, pace, he can easily sort of get easy put away balls.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes he's prone to sort of spraying the forehand, or, you know, sort of going sort of with the finishing shot. Sometimes he can make some unforced errors, but I feel like with time, that's only going to get better. Mm-hmm. And like you mentioned, like, his return of serve was really impressive to me. Like, I feel like he's really improved that shot, and he's getting to neutral off the server, like, much more frequently. And the backhand, like, I've seen him now mix in the slice and the topspin, and he's really, like, it's a solid, like, rally cross court ball now. And he wasn't going down the line, you're right, like, very often with it, but I feel like he could really use that as a nice shield, like, in this game, because he's such a good athlete, and he moves so well around the backhand when he's attacking and hitting inside, mm-hmm. inside out forehand, inside in forehand. Like, you know, I've seen him practice once at Indian Wells, and just the sound that was coming off his racket when he was hitting those inside out forehands and inside in forehands, like, it's a different type of sound, like, to most players, like, on the tour. Like, you really feel the weight of his shot, and I feel mm-hmm. like, yeah, he could. And, you know, even at the net, like, he's gotten a little bit better, I feel like, at taking balls in the air, you know, like, swing volleys, like, put away shots. He's definitely sort of improving slowly in every department. Like, I was watching, listening to the commentary on Tennis TV, and Jim Courier really pointed out that he believes, like when he was playing against Medvedev, like, Medvedev has sort of, like, reached his, you know, pretty much 95 or 100% of yeah. his best level. You know, he's pretty much in his prime right now. Whereas Felix, mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, he mentioned he thinks he's at around 60 or 70%. And if he's at, if somebody like Jim Courier is saying that, who's won four majors and, you know, who's been through it all in the game, then that's really encouraging, because I feel like he's going to make that progress. And for Tony Nadal to come on board, I mean, that's a really good sign right away, because Tony Nadal does not need to be coaching anybody right now.
Yeah.
I can say that for sure. So that means he really sees Felix's work ethic and his professionalism, and I think it just comes through like he's just progressing in every right direction. He's checking every box, basically, in terms of development, like, steady progress.
Yeah
Don't have much to add to that.
No, I feel like, yeah, go ahead.
I was gonna say, even though you know, Russia didn't end up winning the ACP Cup, I thought Medvedev was kind of typically impressive. Like, he had a weird loss in his first match to Hugo Humbert, where he was he probably should have won. I think he was up a set in a break, and a few times he was 2 points away from winning the match. But after that, he had a really, really close match with Berrettini, where after kind of getting destroyed in the first set, Berrettini won a tie break in the second, and then kind of kept the third set close as well. And then Medvedev had that impressive win over Ozhe Aliassime. And I still think, like, he's one of the most difficult matchups on tour for anyone right now. He may be the best rallier in the world, like the best long rallier in the world. Like Vaunch was just saying, I think that Jim Courier said, like, he's at his peak, like, his game is fully mature. And so I think anything besides a title at the Australian Open for him is going to be a disappointment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was about to say, like, I think.
Yeah.
And in that note, like, we always come back to the same point, like, what is the ATP Cup after all? Like, what does it matter? Yeah, I mean, it's not a full title for Felix. We were talking a little bit before we started this episode. I think Bunch said is like half a title for him, which is pretty much literally halfway there for him to actually win, like, his own singles title trophy. And even if it doesn't really mean anything in the tennis world, like, as in, like, does it matter in terms of your achievements? Is Roger Federer going to, like, look himself in the eye and say, like, man, I didn't win the ATP Cup. I could pass of like gold medal in the Olympics, but I wished I had won the ATP. It's just not going to happen, right? It's going to be like, yeah, whatever. Like, and even the things that people say, like, oh yeah, Canada won his first ATP Cup in history. Yeah, it was the third tournament of this kind ever happened. I mean,
right?
There isn't much history to be talking about here, but the players care about it, and I think this is important for them. Like, you could see how much they wanted to win. You could see how much Medvedev wanted to win it. Otherwise, he wouldn't be playing this. And Rublev and I think Karatsev also were supposed to be there. So they also got COVID, so they couldn't participate because they had to quarantine or anything like that. Anyway, complications made it so that they couldn't participate. And I think it also happened for Spain, but I'm not quite sure about it anyways. But players care about it, and because they do, they perform well. And it means that they see and feel the pressure. So those victories that Felix and Chapo had, they were important for them. They were not like just exhibition victories. So, for example, I would say that Chapo beating PCB means more than Chapo beating Nadal in Mubadala, like end of last year. So
for sure, 100%. And the thing is that you get points at the ATP Cup depending on the rank of the player that you beat. And I think, you know, some of the things like about the ATP Cup that I've heard that have some validity, I feel like it's so soon after the Davis Cup. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of an interesting way to open the year. Like, you know, I definitely like some things about it. Like, I like the spirit that the players, obviously have, the camaraderie, the doubles, you know, suddenly becomes really important, obviously, with the one-all when that happens. And the coaches and just the whole vibe of it, like with the crowds, I feel like some areas it could get better is maybe like you could hear a little bit some more, if you could hear a little bit more of the coaching interaction and like just the more of, just more visuals, like visually, I feel like it could do a little bit of a better job. And then, you know, some other things are like, you always have the number one and number one versus two and number two. So sometimes if you have like a withdrawal on an unfortunate situation, like you were mentioning, Andre, with the like, you know, COVID or like, for example, Russia, right? Like they have Safi Yulin. I mean, Safi Yulin is a decent like challenger level player. But then you have other players from other countries where their number two is like, you know, some person that you haven't heard of, or their number two or number three or number four. And those are sort of at the futures or lower tier ITF level. So you could have a match between like a high stakes match, you know, between
Tsitsipas's cousin,
Thanos against Camille Mazurak, or, you know, some guys that like they're really getting a big shot at such a big stage. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, somebody like Khachanov, for example, who's a top 30 player, is sort of robbed of that opportunity. You know what I mean? So I feel like that's one situation. But I feel like they could take the average rank of all the players and sort of like figure out a way to make this a little bit more even, like ranking wise. So you don't have like this polarizing type ranking matchups.
I think something that could be fun is if they said to the teams, like, you know, there's a first slot and the second slot, you decide who goes where. And that way, if you have a great player and a bad player, like bad relatively speaking, of course, you can put your worst player in the top spot, throw that match, and then put your better player against the second player from the other team and try to split them, and then let it all ride on the doubles. Because if you're Greece, let's say, going up against Russia, then you have to put Tsitsipas against Medvedev, knowing he's probably going to lose anyway. But like, if you have the freedom to mix up the spots, you can put someone way worse against Medvedev. You get the same result, still going to lose. And then you can put Tsitsipas, your better player, against someone who he has a better chance of beating. And I feel like that could introduce a fun, like, tactical behind the scenes element. I do understand why it is the way it is, because like, for the fans, it might not be that fun to watch like the world number two beat up on the world number 1000. But like, I don't know, it could be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, to be perfectly honest, Medvedev beat Felix 6-4, 6-love. So it's not like, and Felix is now number nine. So it's not like fans got too much out of their buck for that match. So, you know, first eight games were pretty close and good. But, you know, after that, like, it doesn't really mean much. But yeah, I mean, I don't really know what to say about that. I like the vibe of the ATP Cup. Not sure if it's just because it's on the Australian courts, which I find a beautiful. I feel like the painting job is amazing.
One of my favorites. Yeah.
That shade of blue is so bright. It's amazing.
And just the stadiums, the architecture of them are just beautiful from the inside. And I love the team little booth that they have, like where they can just like talk to the coaches. I think it's just really fantastic. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the tournament does a lot of things well. And Andre, I think it was a great point that a tournament kind of needs history to become prestigious. Like, it's not by coincidence that Wimbledon is still considered like the biggest tournament in the world. It's the oldest. But I think the problem the ATP Cup has is like, it's so soon after the Davis Cup that like, even if the players aren't necessarily burned out, like, I mean, every team that doesn't win, I can see wanting another shot at winning a team competition. Yeah. But for the fans, if you've just watched a team thing, you immediately start the year with another team thing. Like, I think interest could be much higher if they just axed one of those competitions or if they did a better job of spreading them out.
Mm-hmm. I feel like a good solution would be like, win the ATP Cup, you got a free spot in the finals of the Davis Cup. So that way it means that like the Davis Cup is actually the most important tournament. And then the ATP Cup actually allows you to boost your chances. So like, but
yeah,
only for the
that's
winner,
brilliant actually, because it combines them without the need to get rid of one or the other, and but they can still work in concert. Yeah, that's amazing. Send that in to I don't know who the spokesperson for the ATP. I mean, it's probably impossible to get them to do anything right, but you know.
Yeah, I mean, there is much more important things, but I feel like they would be down to listen to people talking about tennis stuff. There would be something for them to focus on that is not like political.
Yeah, no, I mean, that is like genuinely the best solution I've heard to the team thing, though, because I think my issue is like, I wouldn't really care which one they got rid of, but I mean, I think a lot of people would rightfully say, like, you know, Davis Cup has been around for like, what, 150 years or something crazy like that. It wouldn't make a lot of sense to get rid of that in favor of like a really new tournament. But like you said, combining them while maintaining the fact that Davis Cup is bigger would be great.
Yeah.
There were also a few other players where I feel like they really play well this time of the year. Mm-hmm. And it's just so great to see them like have good results. Like, for example, Alex de Minaur, you know, the way he sort of plays like January, I feel like he just peaks during this time of the year. And like he's won Sydney before, he's won 250s like before the Australian Open, and then at the ATP Cup, like he's played some really good matches. I remember the one against Rafa in 2020.
The Delvo forehands for a set and a half.
Right. And then he beat Berrettini this week, which was a really good win, like for him. It was some of the best tennis I've seen him play. And he was struggling like a lot last year, second half of the year. I think he only won like one or two matches like consecutively at one point. So like for a player like that, I feel like this is such a good way to get started in the year, like especially because he has the home crowd support and he can he can show what he's made of. Like, it's a perfect sort of format for him to showcase it. And then same thing with Batista Agut. Like, he's someone who's like, he played a really good match against Hercatch this week, which was like 7-6 in the third from Team Spain, and he pretty much won all his matches except for the one in the final against Felix. So he's somebody who's done pretty well like this time of the year. Like, he's won four titles like all in January and February, and he's always peaked. Like, I remember when he beat Djokovic in 2019 in Doha, you know, and then won the title there. And he's someone who sort of like backed it up at the Australian Open too, right? Like, he made the quarterfinals in 2019.
Yeah, and that was a close match against Tsitsipas as well. I think it could have been closer as well.
So for him, and he's sort of like towards the end of his career now, like 33-34, so he probably doesn't have as much time left, but this is sort of a good month for him to showcase what he's made of. I don't think anybody would want to play him sort of in the third, fourth round of the Australian Open.
Yeah, exactly. He's one of the few guys. Like, he might not beat them, but he can at least play the Djokovic Medvedev game. Stick around, like win a set, make it absolutely miserable for them before they win.
Yeah.
And a lot of players can't even do that. So.
Yeah. I feel like at this point in their careers, I feel like Djokovic would be more weary about seeing RBA in his draw than Medvedev. Just Medvedev would be like, I can probably like play like 10 sets if needed right now.
I mean, I remember that match RBA and Djokovic played in Cincinnati in 2020. There was a stat that was like late in the third set that Batista Agut had hit like one backhand down the line in the match or something. Like, he was hitting everything cross court and just like completely committing to the rallies. Like, I mean, the patience is remarkable and the willingness to suffer. It's a shame he doesn't have, you know, like a bigger title to show for it.
Yeah. It doesn't have a bigger weapon either. So that's probably one of the reasons, but
Yeah. So, I mean, that's pretty much the ATP Cup. Is there anything else?
I don't know. Go Canada. Let's see what happens next year.
Yeah. Congratulations, Andre.
Felix and Dennis can really make some progress in Australia as well.
For sure.
Felix, last year was, everybody sort of hit, was critical of him after he lost from two sets to love against Karatsev. But I mean, that's pretty good, because look at what Karatsev went on to do after that. So
yeah, I mean, Felix and Dennis played each other in Australia last year.
That was one of their better matches.
Felix hit like arguably the shot of the tournament. In my eyes, in that match, like Schaffo kind of spiked an overhead into the open court, and Felix hit this forehand down the line pass while like running backwards. He almost like walked into the advertising board when he was celebrating. It was crazy.
Yeah.
I gotta go watch that again. I'm pretty sure I put that in a compilation, but then I forget now.
Nice. I didn't do a good job of describing it. I'll send the link.
It's just really nice to see like these two friends sort of like in the same phase of their careers, you know, like this sort of, they're doing it together. It's like they grew up in the juniors together. Like they've known each other like for years, and they're just sort of like, if one is playing well, the other is trying to sort of match them or do better than them.
It's fun for now, guys, but wait until one of them beats the other in a major final from like two sets down, then the friendship will be forever destroyed.
It's gonna be like a very interesting like dynamic of like rivalry if they end up being like consistently meeting in like big matches.
I feel like it could be with like a Djokovic and one of Federer and Nadal, where like you watch those compilations and you can see the handshakes getting progressively colder as like time goes on.
I feel like and that's like maybe a nod for The Master, the book that I just finished, and but like it's in maturity also would come with like Federer and Nadal probably gotten a little bit warmer in their handshakes and later in their careers, because they probably realized, man, we're old, but we're here fighting still.
I think the first time I actually watched them play doubles was against Djokovic and Anderson after they just played the Wimbledon final. I think this was in 2018.
Rogers Cup, right? I was actually at a match where Djokovic and Anderson played doubles. I only saw a few points and I lost, but I was there.
I was like, wow, these two are some people to watch out for. Definitely. And they'd already sort of made their name by then.
Mm.
Would be kind of interesting. Somebody who's made his name is indeed Nadal, right? Winning another title.
Yeah.
Last week.
It's true.
89th of his career. And, you know, after a long layoff, time off, so what do we think about his, sort of his form, and how did he look last week? Like, he played three matches, you know, against,
He didn't drop a set.
He served for the match and then got back, and same thing happened against Rusevori and against Cressy.
First set he was down, set Cressy served at 6-5 in the tiebreak. I wasn't that impressed with, like, you know, the path to the title. I think it's like no one inside the top 50 or 70 or 90 or something like that. But I was impressed, because I honestly didn't expect Nadal to win the title. I think, like, coming off from a layoff, playing on hard courts, sometimes he takes some time to find his form. And I mean, it was patchy a lot of the time, but he also had a couple of points where he looks like his old self. I think the next to last point against Rusevori, he played this brilliant point where he kind of defended for a while, and then like slowly started to open up the court, and like one time in the rally got time on a forehand and then like ripped it inside in, and Rusevori was leaning the other way. That felt very vintage. I think the best sign is that there was no apparent issues with his movement. The foot seemed fine. So that's a big green light for Australia, or the Australian Open, because he's actually playing on Rod Laver, which was weird to get used to, but sorry.
Oh, yeah, that was... Yeah, some fans were sort of just joking, this is his second Australian Open.
Yeah.
But it was kind of interesting, because, you know, obviously Nadal the last couple of years has sort of sometimes struggled to put away matches, like in big moments.
Yeah.
You know, on a hard court especially. So, like, that'll be something just to watch for, I think, as he just gets older and does this for as long as his body can, you know, cope with it.
Mm-hmm.
But like, you're right. Like, it was patchy at some points, and at some points his forehand wasn't working like as well as it normally does, which is like the key for his baseline aggression. And a few times, like the serve, you know, a little bit up and down, and sort of, you know, tentative in some spots. And the first set against Cressy, he could have lost it. Cressy had a set point, and was up a break in the second set as well. But then Nadal played like this vintage game to break back, where he hit three winners, three return winners.
Yeah, and they're all off the forehand, all down the line, all from the ad side. And like, sorry, like I've actually been thinking a lot about this because I'm like, it's so unlikely that that stretch of play would happen, right? Like, what are the odds that Cressy serves to the ad side for a third time in a row after he's been burnt twice? And what are the odds that Nadal guesses that? Because I feel like you would like obviously be expecting a serve to the backhand after you've just hit two good forehand returns. So I'm like, I've been like weirdly thinking about these permutations where I'm like, was Cressy smart to like try to trick him by going to the same place? Like, obviously not because it didn't work, but I feel like it would have worked in a lot of situations. True. Anyway, sorry, that's just a bit of a tangent. Yeah, but that was a fun bit.
It's an interesting thought, right? Like if you serve twice to the same spot and then it doesn't work, like should you play on the other side? Like, as in, like, are the chances better if you play like down the middle? Like if you play like at and it didn't work? Like, I mean, in a sense, maybe, because like you're playing like on a different shot and you're changing out tactics a little bit. Maybe Nadal would be a little bit more like comfortable like going there. I think also Nadal is not really the type that constantly just guesses the serve. Like, as in, he does not like, I think he's kind of on in between like guessing and reacting. So
yeah,
like,
yeah. I mean, standing far back lets him kind of lean either way.
Yeah, but at the same time, like it would be interesting, like, Nadal definitely like thinking maybe two steps ahead of like maybe he's gonna serve like on the ad side now. And back to what do I think about this title? I think on clay, if it was on clay, like you had this exact same path to the title, I'd be like, that's iffy. I'm not sure he's gonna make it. But like on hard courts, I feel like a match is a match for Nadal. Like, as in, it's not his bestest surface. Like, he's past his prime by some margin now, I would say, especially on this surface. So I think for him to get used to it is more important than just getting physically in shape. He's probably in shape now that he took some time off last year. And I think he just needed to get match fit. And I think this is really important for him to actually feel the court and like measure like how he's gonna hit his forehand, like how much time he has to hit, how he's gonna hit his serves. And I think he got a good amount of match quality for himself. Like, he wasn't too hard, but he wasn't too easy either. So like he got to play some pressure points when he was down set points and down breaks. So I think he's gonna look at this as a huge positive for him to Australia, which is still a long shot. Like, if he doesn't, even if Djokovic doesn't go, he would still probably have to get past Medvedev and Mr. World Number 3 German guy, but whose name I've already said many, many a time in this podcast, but apologies. But in any case,
these sort of opponents were sort of the caliber of player he'd face in the first or second round.
Yeah, exactly.
Of a major. So I think, you know, I think this gives him like more confidence, especially like in a best of five set match. I think he'll be able to trust his body to at least get through those early rounds because he's just still that much better than everybody else.
Yeah.
But I feel like the real big hurdles will sort of come in the quarters onwards. But the other thing to remember is like just how difficult this road is.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And for Rafa the last 6 months, I think really like after that loss to Djokovic in Paris, Rubino in the fourth set, he was struggling quite a bit with his foot and then took those 2 months off. I think his game was really not where it needed to be in Washington physically. Like when he came back and he played those two matches against Jack Sock and Lloyd Harris. And then just like he had to take the rest of the year off, and for 2 or 3 months he just wasn't able to train, and he was having to, like, this has been a chronic problem in his foot, right, since 2005.
Yep.
And just the older you get, you know, he's going to be 36 in June. Just, you know, in some ways it's good because it's like an injury he's had before and he sort of knows how to manage it. But it's also just getting harder and harder to recover and keep on coming back. And it just shows like what a fighter he is, you know, that he just keeps on doing this time and time again and actually coming back and winning, you know, not just coming back and just, you know, being at the top. Like he still finished the year last year in the top 10 and he still finished at world number 6. So like, you know, for him, he's, and I would say like he on a hard court, he is sort of right behind the Medvedev and Zverev like crop. So like he will have to get through, you know, probably one of those, you know, on his way, but
Is it a good time for you to plug your article, Owen?
I was gonna say I wrote like 4,500 words on Nadal in the Australian Open. I was like, before bed one night, I was kind of scribbling some stuff in a notebook, and then like it turned off my light. I think like 10 to 15 times I thought of like a new thing I wanted to say, and I had to like get back off and write that down. But anyway, like it's still so weird to project Nadal's chances at the Australian Open. Because, like, I mean, we know if he plays Djokovic, he won't win. Like, that's a given. But, like, besides that, I can't really figure out. I'm like, can he get past the quarterfinals? Or is there, like, a faint chance that he could win? Because I think, you know, Medvedev and Zverev, he'd be a solid underdog in those matches. But I think under the right circumstances, it is possible that he could win them. Then there's the factor of, like, I mean, he might have gotten some match practice on hard court, but he hasn't gotten match practice against, like, really, really high-ranked and foreign players on hard court. You know, best of five, how is his body going to hold up? So I think, like Vaughn said, he's good enough that I don't see him losing to anyone in the first two or three rounds. But after that, I think it's really, really hard to predict. So he's one of the players that I'm most excited to watch just because, like, he's got a long, long history with the Australian Open, and I really have no idea how it's going to go this year.
Do you guys think he could beat Medvedev if they meet in a final, for example, or semi? Because like he could get lucky, like Federer did, and lucky in 2017 and 18, where like
his four main top opposition, 10 players,
and his main opposition was not necessarily there. Like Djokovic wasn't playing,
right?
And Medvedev was still not the player that he is, and so wasn't team. He did have to get past Nadal, which was a challenge in itself, like for Federer, which just seems like even more unsurmountable than you know, at the moment. I mean, but at the same time,
he sort of had Djokovic and Murray injured.
They lost in like the first round, or they didn't play, or something like that.
His main sort of rivals at that time were like, you know, Wawrinka, Nishikori, Del Potro, Rafa.
But could Nadal beat Medvedev?
It's a good question.
I think it's a tough matchup, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think in a final, Nadal would have the best chance because he could just go in with a mindset like, I'll play this like it's the last match of my life and just go for every forehand. And I think like in a semi, the mindset is a little bit different because you still have one more match, and you're going to be less inclined to get drawn into a marathon. This matchup still intrigues me because the head-to-head is 3-1 for Nadal, but he hasn't beaten Medvedev for over 2 years now. And the last match they played, which Medvedev won at the World Tour Finals, even though Nadal served for a straight sets win, in the end, it kind of felt like a really decisive win for Medvedev because he came back to win the second set and then won the third and like 6-3, two breaks. And by the end, Nadal looked gassed. And, you know, that's going to be even tougher in best of five. So I think I would have Medvedev as a pretty heavy favorite in this matchup now, just because like,
The defensive physicality, I feel like.
Exactly. Like, even as good as Nadal is at the net, it's still, like, I mean, best of five. He would have to win the match at the net, I think. Or just tee off successfully on his forehand for 4 hours. I think those are really big asks.
By the way, just reminded me how much I love that matchup. Because both guys are thinkers on the court. And they both sort of have to win at the net. Because I remember, you know, especially in the U.S. Open, the match was won at the net.
Yeah, like the points aren't going to end otherwise.
Then you had the World Tour Finals match in 2019, where Medvedev had that 5-1, 40-30 lead in the third set. So you're right. Like, it's 3-1, but it really it could be like 2-2 or, you know, 3-1 in Medvedev's favor.
Yeah, exactly.
Really, I couldn't imagine Nadal throwing in like a bunch of serve and volleys, like especially on Ed's side, like using his lighter to the backhand. Medvedev is so far away, like Nadal can just like hit like a nice volley, because he's a good volleyer, like obviously not best of all time, not a serve and volleyer at all, but he could probably pull it off. Like, I think,
you know, and that's
he would definitely have to win it in four, I would say, probably. I think five sets definitely favors.
That's definitely a tactic that Humbert used really well against Medvedev, because I feel like he could rush him and he could also work the angles.
Yeah,
and he was unpredictable, and he could just, you know, inject a lot of pace or just go after the shots, finish at the net, like keep him sort of guessing.
Yeah,
you know, bring him forward, like all of these things, just not give him enough rhythm. And especially, I think also the thing about Medvedev that it re-emphasized for me is that I want to see Medvedev play a really close match in a major, like go to a fifth set. And just see how he responds, because I feel like because he's so efficient and because he has such a good return of serve and serve combination, and he's a wall from the baseline, and he's, you know, pretty much like, you know, a favorite to win the title, like anything less, like you Owen said, would be sort of a disappointment. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, how does he do when he has to play back-to-back physical matches? Or because even in the Umber match, I mean, I'll give him a pass because it was sort of the first match of the season, and he didn't really quite have the longest off season because he played Davis Cup. And so I'm not going to really use that against him that much because, you know, I mean, that's just one match. He played really well the rest of the week. But like in a best of five set match, I want to see him see how he sort of does physically, because he can cramp sometimes. He can, there's still sort of question marks there. And so if Nadal can sort of go to the trenches with him many times, then it'll be fascinating.
I think. Yeah. I mean, this is something I really want to see as well. Like, despite Medvedev having won a major last year, made the finals of both hardcourt majors, I feel like his signature match is still that US Open final loss to Nadal. Because, I mean, if you look at the matches he played at hardcourt majors last year, and you guys are free to crucify me for reducing his US Open final win to this, but like all 13 of the matches he won at hardcourt majors were all pretty easy wins against opponents who did not play that well. Like, there's not a signature win in there. Like, at the Australian Open, I think Krajinovic maybe pushed him to five, but
was the one where his coach sort of left.
Yeah, and his coach left, and then Medvedev bageled him in the fifth. Like, there hasn't been a match where, like, both players have played extremely well.
Yeah.
Like, all last year at the hardcourt majors, that didn't happen. Like, against Djokovic at the US Open, Djokovic was, you know, not himself, and Medvedev won really easily. And so, like, I think that's kind of why some people are yet to be totally convinced by Medvedev, even though, like we've said, he's in his prime, maybe even at his peak. He's won a major, a bunch of other titles. I mean, like you, I love the Medvedev Nadal matchup. So I think that could be a great match if they played in the quarters or the semis. And I think if Medvedev could win that in like a tight four or something, that could just be another step for his confidence.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think that's my last point about this. I feel like Medvedev, I'm convinced that he's by far and wide like the world number two, like as in he could even be rivaling like for number one. Like, I think he could even do better this season on clay and grass. He did pretty well on clay last year, which is kind of against all odds pretty much.
The French Open,
He didn't start well on that clay season and finish pretty well, except for the last serve that he did, but
he won more matches at the French Open than he did in like all the lead-up tournaments exactly. in the clay season,
which is crazy to think about. But I feel like he could go down as either the best player of his generation or one of the best players in history. Like, it's up to like what happens next for him. Like, is he going to be tested enough? Is there going to be something? And even if he's not tested, if there's nobody there that he can actually compete with him, is he going to like reach Roger Federer levels of dominance in which he's going to win like 10 out of the last like 14 majors? You know what I mean?
I think his window is also, you know, not that big, like because he's going to be 26, and because you have, you know, your Hungry Canadians, you have Sinner, you have Alcaraz. You know, and Tsitsipas, I mean, right now is not there, but he's, you know, he still has a lot of things to work on, but he's 2.5 years younger. And then so you like, you know, the window isn't as big, I feel like, because new generation is coming, and it's crazy to think like new generation's coming. I mean, this generation
already, we've had new generations coming for the last 15 years. But yeah, I mean, I think it is a really interesting question. I've thought for a while that Medvedev had the makings to be an all-time great player, because I think if you look at his game, that is a package that any tennis player would kill to have. Like on hard courts right now, he should not be losing to anyone ever, unless it's a peaking Novak Djokovic. Like that, that's it really. And you know, Djokovic is going to age out before Medvedev does. So maybe Medvedev can have a year or two where he just wins absolutely everything on hard courts. But you know, it depends on him. He's prone to bouts of inconsistency. He can lose his focus. So, I mean, if he can really corral that for a little bit and just let his game fly, I think he can win a lot. Mm-hmm. Like, I think he can exceed what Murray did. Won't necessarily be as impressive because Murray had the big three in their younger days to contend with. But yeah, I think
nice save. Otherwise, the Murray musings are good friends.
Right. They're not going to want to do a podcast with us ever again. But yeah, I mean, I think like it's all out there for Medvedev. Like the limit to what he can accomplish is extremely high.
Yeah. And so, just to talk about, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, when we were bringing up Medvedev and sort of his window, and I was sort of thinking a little bit about the WTA and just looking at,
I was about to say the same thing.
Looking at sort of Barty and Halep winning titles this week.
Yeah.
You know, as sort of a reminder, like, you know, how they sort of have that ability to like play one match in the tournament.
Mm-hmm.
Where they're down and they're struggling and they're about to lose, and then they just find a way through that one match, because they've been in major finals and they've been in big matches now. Mm-hmm. and then they come through and they win the title decisively in the end. I just thought that was really impressive from both of them this week.
Yeah,
like Barty had that match against Coco Gauff in the first round where Gauff was playing really well and Barty was mistiming the ball and not finding her range at all, and she was down 6-4. She lost the first set 6-4, and she was down in break and break point for double break. And then she came back, and then within 30 minutes, that match had completely flipped around. And then the way she just decisively beat Kenin and Rybakina, and mm-hmm. I mean, Rybakina was the final, and Swiatek in the semis. Yeah. Like, these are good players, and she's down. She's beating them convincingly, like in later rounds of tournaments. And she's doing it like at such a consistent rate when she's playing on the tour. Like, this is her first time playing since the US Open. And then same thing with like Simona Halep. You know, I've heard rumors like last year that she's like towards the end of her career, or she's, you know, sort of going in the direction of retirement. And well, she completely thwarted those rumors last week because I was watching her play like some of the highlights, and then the match against Golubic, I think, was like the one match where like she wasn't she up like 6-2, 4-2, and then Golubic like made it really physical, and they had some really great points, and it sort of brought out the best in Halep at the very end.
Yeah.
And then she won it 6-4 in the third. And
this I want to talk about for a while, because I turned on my TV when they were at like 3-3 in the third, and immediately the tennis was so good. Like neither of them have great serves, and neither of them was serving that well. So that meant like every serve was coming back, and every point was like a 10+ shot rally. It was absolutely exhausting tennis. And so you had both of them just trying to destroy backhands down the line. I mean, in the 4-4 game, Halep hit this kind of somehow slips this backhand down the line past Golubic at net when she was like by the Melbourne sign, hit it when it was like 6 inches off the ground. And then she kind of played a similar point to break where Golubic kept hitting. It looks like she had been wrong footed like 3 different times, and she kind of like somehow managed to stop and lean to her left and hit this pass. And she celebrated that more emphatically than she celebrated in the entire 2018 Australian Open, which was wild to me. I mean, and watching her on Rod Laver was kind of a similar vibe to watching Nadal there, because it was like she as well has played so many crazy matches on that court, and not for very much reward either. She doesn't have a title in Australia. Well, I mean, technically she does now, but not at the Australian Open. So yeah, I mean, I love to watch her play as well. She defends so well, always willing to take her backhands down the line. Really aggressive, but without a ton of easy power. And I just find that tennis like really, really fun to watch. So she's another one I can't wait to see at the Australian Open.
Yeah.
I've loved sort of watching her over time too, because she's like not a counterpunching type player. Like she's really also can play aggressive.
Yeah.
She's sort of gotten more aggressive as her career has gone on, and it's like a healthy and fit Halep, like back in the mix, like, yes, please, it's, you know, for one sentence. Because, like,
just, yeah,
which is crazy. Like a magnet for these
good matches.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think it's funny too, because when it comes to the WTA, like, there's a lot of great players in the mix, and a lot of them you genuinely want them to win a title, or like a title that they're missing. Like, for example, we just talked about Halep and Barty, and I literally want both of them to win the Australian Open. Like, right. Halep, because it would just really be just super cathartic for her. Like, it would definitely be like a title that she deserves. Mm-hmm. And for Barty, like, she hasn't played particularly well in big moments in the past couple of years in Australia, probably because of a bit of like the pressure of playing like the home slam, which hasn't had an Australian winner since God knows how long at this moment, but like, right. Yeah. And she's number one.
Tomic will win in like 5 years.
Once he
Thomas is going to single-handedly win, just hitting slices.
Oh, God.
He stops complaining about how he's going to get tested positive.
Yeah,
true.
I should have thought through that joke before I made it. But yeah, I mean, I do agree with you, Andre. Like, yeah. I will admit that Halep, at some point in her career, I want her to win the Australian Open. Yeah. Like, every time
kind
she
like
plays
Andy
there.
Murray.
Yeah, exactly. Like, every time she plays there, I mean, and I could talk for an hour about this, but I think of like 2018, where she played a match in the third round, 15-13 in the third, saved 3 match points. Semifinal, 9-7 in the third, saved 2 match points. Mm-hmm. In the final, third set against Wozniacki, Halep is up a break at 4-3, and then loses 3 games in a row. Like, kind of gasses out right as Wozniacki started to peak. And then, I mean, has gets the runner off plate, and then she has to go to the hospital for like heat exhaustion and dehydration. I'm like, that is brutal. Like, to push yourself that hard and not win. Like, I think if the tennis gods are merciful, like, Halep will win the Australian Open before her career ends.
And I mean, it would be so great also for, you know, like, for Barty, because she's from because of Australian and the support that she has and connection with Yvonne Goolagong, all those other things. Mm-hmm. Right, like, mm-hmm. for her to win at home is really big, because I mean, sort of the last 2 or 3 years, she sort of felt the pressure a lot in a big match, like towards the end of the tournament, and it just hasn't worked out for her.
Yeah.
And you know, when players, when fans and people on Twitter and just other people, like, when they talk about women's tennis, sort of like Halep and Barty are the only two players, like, sort of post-Serena era, who've cemented their place as, like, consistent world number ones. Mm-hmm. You know, with Barty finishing 3 years in a row, and then Halep, like, finally winning a major in 2018, and then finishing year at number one 2017 and 2018. So I think it sort of gets undersold, because there's no, like, one dominant player. But these two, like, in the last 4 or 5 years, I mean, not so much Halep anymore, have sort of, like, they sort of have that mantle as, like, consistent, like, well-deserving number ones at some point.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is not a very eloquent way to say it, but, like, Barty is just so good. Like, when she's playing well, it's ridiculous. Like, I could, if she keeps it up, I could genuinely see her ending her career with like 200 weeks at number one or something crazy like that.
Yeah, the, like, goal for her is, like, win all 4 majors, like, get the calendar year. I mean, get the career slam.
Yeah, like, I mean, the way she's able to serve at 5 feet and 5 inches is ridiculous. Like, she must have the best technical motion of anyone in the world. Mm-hmm. Like, because she pops in aces and, like, service winners better than people who are, like, 6 inches taller than her. It is unreal. I think we were talking before the start of this podcast, like, against Kennan, she hit 17 aces in 2 sets. Like, it's absurd. Her slice is, like, the best in the world. Like, everyone, and whenever she comes up, people are like, yeah, the weakness is the topspin backhand, and that's true, but it's like, you can't really do anything about it, because, like, if you hit it to her backhand, she's going to slice every shot, like, keep the ball in play. And that slice is a really tricky shot to handle, because she can go anywhere with it. It's got a ton of movement. And then the forehand is just one of the heaviest shots on tour. She can use the slice to set up the forehand. It feels like when she plays, like, practically every match is on her racket.
And she can do anything with that forehand too, right? She can blast it, like, cross court or down the line. She can use the angles really nicely. She can keep it in play. She literally has a game that you don't really see it, like, falling apart that easily. She could really beat pretty much anybody, and could be a tough match, but she has the tools to stay in the match and, like, to defend her serve. So yeah, it was just probably frustrating and disappointing, really, for her to not win the Australian Open in the last two editions that she's played.
Yeah.
She's definitely lost matches that she should have won, especially last year. So
I think that's the thing for me about her is like she beats everybody. She beats all of her rivals, like in the top 10 and top 20.
Yeah,
it's those odd matches, like the one against Shelby Rogers at the U.S. Open, or like
that was the one
against Mukhova at the Australian Open, or like, you know, some matches here and there, but like just and I was watching the match against Swiatek, and you think like Swiatek has one of the heaviest forehands in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
And when she's peaking, like in the way she can just, because it's such a heavy shot, and she's so good. She was so good getting to that semifinal that I legitimately thought for a second, like, this could be a really competitive three setter.
I thought that too. And it was not close at all. Like,
and it just was not close. Like, yeah. Swiatek just looked, I mean, Swiatek looked helpless. I don't even think she played a bad match at all.
Yeah. Like, she was trying so hard. Like, she clearly wanted to win really badly and just wasn't getting anywhere.
Barty was just so good. Yeah. Like, I mean, yeah. And just the way she could sort of hits like her inside in forehand and like keeps you you just can't read the forehand side. It's so.
Yeah.
You can't read the serve. The forehand is so versatile, and you don't know where is it going inside in? Is it going inside out? It's like, and then the angle she can find on it, and even like her topspin backhand, like she can hit good like passing shots with it, or like good, she can change directions with it, or she can go down line.
Slice lobs.
Yeah, I mean, like she's like a number one. So when we say like her topspin backhand is a weakness, what we really mean is it's like marginally worse than most people's backhands. Like it's not like you hit it to her backhand and she immediately loses the point. Like it takes work to pick it apart.
It's like talking about Roger Federer in a sense, like just hit to his backhand. Exactly.
Yeah, like no, it's way more complicated than that. Yeah. It's crazy. I like the Federer comparison because like her forehand is like, I mean, I don't want to compare it directly to Federer's, but it's like that same category of forehands. Like she can hit it from anywhere to anywhere, end the rally with one shot, don't know where it's going. Like it's one of the most huge shots on tour.
Yeah,
for sure.
Speaking of Swiatek, like, I mean, when I remember just the match that I saw her, like was playing against Fernandez, she just couldn't miss. And she moves incredibly well too. Like she slides so nicely on the hard court. Like you'd think like she can defend pretty much against anybody. And the fact that she lost so convincingly, like I feel like it's I don't know. Like I don't even know what to think. Like what can she do better? Like in those situations, like Swiatek has had a little bit of an issue, like to getting past like later rounds in hard court tournaments. But I mean, I guess this one could be a class. Could be qualified a little bit differently. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like good experience, because like she beat Azarenka, you know, before that, who I thought was playing really well, and like you said, like her defense, sliding around the court, like her, just like she didn't do much wrong even against Barty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, like maybe just the forehand, like you can just rush it a little bit easier.
Yeah,
and she can look a little bit. She can be made to look a little bit slow on that wing. You know, kind of like an aging Rafa, I guess, if you want to put it that way, or like, you know. Maybe sometimes she just, because she also wins a lot of matches like very convincingly, like the one against Fernandez or her run at the Roland Garros title, matches like that. She just needs like just more time on the tour. I feel like she's still so new. It's crazy, but like it's like last year was her first full year.
Yeah, exactly. And players like Raducanu who've like success with even less experience kind of take the focus off the fact that Swiatek still lacks a lot of experience. And yeah, I mean, look, like this match kind of reminds me of, Barty is just a terrible matchup for most players as well. Like at Wimbledon in the semifinals, like she beat Kerber, like close first set, blowout second set. And I was like, Kerber played well, you know, like I don't really know what you can take from a match like that where you play well and you lose in straights and it's not because like you failed to win a few big points. I think like the cruel fact of that is like the player who beats you is a solidly better player. And you have to improve a lot or hope that they have a bad day to change the result.
Yeah. I think it's really a matter of game style. Like I feel like a lot of players in the WTA like are very used to just rallying and using topspin most of the time. And I think Barty really brings in this slice. A bigger serve, which is kind of creeping back into the WTA now. Like, a lot of players have good serves and are trying to serve better. Like, especially, it's probably the Serena effect that took a long time to come to fruition. But yeah, I feel like serving well and using sliced backhands to, like, you know, disrupt play, I think it's a characteristic that Barty is a master of, like, in WTA Tour.
And it's hilarious to me that there was, like, a movement on tennis Twitter saying, like, her game is boring. Like, she is one of the most unique games out of anyone. Like, this is, it's the opposite of boring. I mean, and it's, like, even allowing for subjectivity. And, like, her, no one plays like she does, you know? So, yeah, I mean, I really hope that, like, she's healthy for the entire year, like, plays everywhere and plays, like, all the top players. Because I think she could do some really amazing things.
Mm-hmm. You know, speaking of top players, and when you were mentioning Swiatek, I didn't realize this, but, like, Amanda Anisimova, right, mm-hmm. has sort of fallen off. She won a title this week, or she won a title last week. Like, she was the first to, like, make a major semifinal of sort of, like, the young group in Roland Garros in 2019, and she was less than 18 years old, you know. Mm-hmm. And now she finally wins a title. She's working with Darren Cahill. It was such a good story, like, just to see her back. She's one of the best, like, ball strikers on tour. She played that really good match against Pliskova at the US Open, 7-6 in the third. Like, she's somebody who I think could have a really good year this year. And finally, she's sort of come to terms with, like, because she's really struggled, like, the last 2.5 years. Like, she lost her father. She had injuries. She lost some confidence. She finally started to get it back sort of at the end of last year. And now she's working with Darren Cahill, who worked with Simona Halep for 6 years. And she was down 3-love in the third set against Šašnjović in the final, and she ended up winning. And she had some really, really good, like, results this week. Like, she beat Kazakina 6-2, 6-love in the semifinals. You know, just a blowout win. I feel like with her ball striking and her movement is somewhat always limited at this point in her career, but, like, she's definitely somebody who can make a push to the very top of the game, like, or contend for majors,
and I mean, add to the list of her, the rally ball is one of the heaviest out of anyone on tour. I mean, she was playing a match against Pliskova at the US Open, and, like, when they were rallying, it felt like each shot had the weight of, like, a house or something. Like, it can guarantee it would have knocked me down. But yeah, it's amazing, and that's it's a huge asset to have, because it means, like, when you play at your best, you can overpower almost anyone.
Yeah, for sure. Her backhand is just money.
Yeah.
Like, she can change directions with it, go down the line, cross court. It's such a pure shot, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, and just as a last topic, maybe, since right now we're back into talking to, like, young generational players, like, we talked a little bit before the podcast about Raducanu and her results. She obviously hasn't done too well after the US Open, but what do you guys think? Like, I haven't watched her play, but honestly don't know exactly how 6-love 6-1 looks like. You know, like, she definitely, if she played well, her opponent Rybakina must have played, like, an insanely good match to win it at that score. So I'm just assuming that either Rybakina played, like, a really good match and kind of disrupted Raducanu a lot, or Raducanu just really was too rusty and didn't play her game at all. But what do you guys think about, like, maybe, I don't want to project too far into this year because we really didn't see much of her, even though she's a Grand Slam champion, but, like, even for the Australian Open, just, which is just around the corner.
I didn't really see the match, so I can't comment on that front, but I think it's kind of important to remember that, like, the player Emma Raducanu ends up being at the end of her career, we may not know at all yet. And she's still, I think, 18 or 19. I'm not sure, but, you know, she's so little experience still. Like, that US Open was unbelievable and it was incredible. And we can acknowledge all that while also acknowledging, like, to do it again will be, like, even tougher. So many experiences still to be had. I don't know if she's had kind of like Medvedev almost, like, she won it so uneventfully that, like, I don't know if she's had, like, a signature win yet where, like, she's had to fight from behind or, like, save some match points, or beat, like, the world number one. So I think, like, I think, like, until I don't know, like 3, 4, or 5 years down the line when she's actually gotten to like experience the tour more. I don't think it's smart to pass judgment on any of her matches, like no matter how crazy they might be.
Yeah, I agree. For me, like I wasn't too worried, you know, even by the scoreline 6-1. I think she lost a match like that at the end of the year last year also. You know, and I saw some quotes from her, like I didn't see this match completely, but like Rybakina has been in really good form. Like she made the final last week and lost to Barty, and she's like a pretty much a top 10 player, like when she's playing really, really well, and she's a top 15 player. So like I just saw some quotes from her like after the match, and she said she's always so like matured and reassuring, like even after big wins and losses. And she said this was her second time playing competitive points in 2 months. And she's pretty confident that she can brush it off and keep going. And, you know, to lose a match 6-1, 6-1. And then she said she goes to the practice court right after the match and just started hitting because she just wants to keep putting herself there, even if she just gets knocked down, and then just keep starting over, you know, again and again, and just build, you know, because she didn't have that last year. She really just climbed up 500 levels. So like for her, this is all just like a slow and steady progress. Now it's kind of like you've won a major, now your career starts. It's such a weird way of putting it, but like I feel like that's just where she's at right now. It's just unprecedented completely.
Yeah. And I think it's going to be fascinating to see like how her arc ends up looking. Like, is it going to be like, is it actually a disadvantage to kind of experience the glory first? Because now, like, usually when most people win a major, it's like they're fully formed, like we just saw with Medvedev. But with her, it's like she won a major, but now it's like there's still all these obstacles ahead. Like, you know, she needs to still like get her heart broken by a loss and, you know, experience the grind for a few years and see if like it's something that she can handle without kind of having a lapse in motivation like Team did recently. Stuff like that. And so I almost wonder if like as a player, it's more ideal to like go through all that before you win a major, because then it's almost like you can just like there's nothing stopping you from like winning more of them. Whereas for Raducanu, it's like I said, there are all these obstacles in the way. So I'm really interested to see how that turns out.
Yeah. I think what I just want is like, you know, just people to like sort of just go easy on her, because it's just really tough. Like your whole life just changes in a flash beat. Like I'd really just love for her to get like a really nice reception at Wimbledon, or like hopefully a really deep run by then, you know, just like go out and just play without any sort of expectations or whatever, because I feel like expectations are like low now. And people have sort of understood that, you know, like this week, like I didn't hear that much even about this match, and she lost 6-1, 6-1. So I think that's a good sign that people are starting to recognize that. With her game, like if, you know, on a fast court, if she's playing well, like there's no, you know, I mean, she's anywhere from the first round to like the fourth round or something at the Australian Open. Like for me, it's like, you know, anything really, because like she had COVID and she hadn't played in 2 months. I mean, that's a long time. It's not ideal to a major. That's for sure.
So I think for me, like this year, it could be really good for her if she puts herself like in the right mindset, because, well, we can deny that she now has a lot of money. So that's something that already puts her in a big advantage of like amongst many players who are her age at this point, because she has her, you know, she's developing physically still, and so she's young, she can recover faster. So if she plays grinding matches, like she can still come back. And she having the money, she can like just put it like, hey, let's take this year and just like see what happens, right? Like she can play without like lower expectations, just really filling out the tour. And she won't have the pressure of like performing and like winning many matches and like going deep in tournaments, because she has like a little bit of a safety net. Of course, you cannot rely on that for forever. Like, and I also don't think that maybe experiencing glory, like taking this year, just be like, hey, like I'm probably not going to win another major this year. And like just doing this, just seeing how it goes, like not putting too much pressure on herself. Like she can get the experience, get the matches going on, just seeing like experiencing other players as well, because at her ranking she's going to be facing more players who are like top 50, top 30. If she goes deeper in a tournament, she's probably going to be facing top 15, top 10 players as well. So the glory could probably come back to her mind like next year, or maybe at the end of this year. Like the US Open, there's no reason why she wouldn't try to defend her title, right? But at the same time, she wouldn't be like, hey, like now I'm going to go for the Australian Open as well, which is, I won't say unrealistic, because as Vansh said, is unprecedented. Who knows? Maybe she's going to win the Grand Slam this year, you know, like.
Maybe she just peaks at the majors, you know?
Yeah. I mean, like, she already did the US Open. Like, we have no idea what's going to happen. Like, the odds of that happening are low, but so were for the US Open as well. But, you know, I feel like if she takes it right, she can develop herself into, like, a consistent top 10 player.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, her game is mind-blowingly good when it's working. We saw that at the US Open. So now it's just all about trying to reproduce that as soon as possible.
She just has all the tools now in her bag, and money included. You know what I mean? So
I feel like all the title winners of last week were just like players that people just love to root for, you know, like just the happy players. I mean, you have Nadal, you have Halep, you have Nsimova, you have Monfils winning a title at 35 and a half, you know, so good to see him back, like playing really well. And then you have, then you had Osaka finally back on the court, winning three matches and then sort of just conserving her body. So like, and you know, the last few times she's sort of withdrawn, you know, before, like a tune-up before a hardcore major, she's gone and won it. I mean, I'm not saying she's going to do that this time, but it's just nice to see her sort of back and healthy after all the struggles she had last year.
Yeah, especially because, in my opinion, like, Osaka is probably the best hardcore player, like, right now.
Yes.
If she's playing well, I think she's pretty much unbeatable.
Yeah, I agree. Although, like, I want to see so badly a hardcore major final between Osaka and Barty. I feel 100%. Like that. I feel like that would be like, okay, who's the best player in the world?
That needs to happen.
Oh my god, I hope we get that so badly. So this is a bit of a tangent, but do you guys remember Stu Fraser this past week asked Nadal a question in press where he's like, "No, you haven't made the semis of the Australian Open since you won it in 2009." And Nadal kind of had that reaction. He's like, "What do you mean?" And then he like explains, like, "No, these are all the years I made the final." Do you guys remember that?
I do, yeah. And I remember there were like memes about his face.
Yes, exactly. So on Twitter, Neil Harmon, who is a guy who used to be a tennis journalist for The Times and eventually got like fired or resigned from all his positions because he plagiarized from the Wimbledon annual yearbook. He basically said on Twitter, "Oh dear, The Times ain't what they used to be," to like make fun of Stu Fraser. And Stu responded, "Thanks, Neil. A very busy week, but still a brain fade that I'm struggling to explain, having attended two of the four finals he mentions. Anyway, not sure you're in a great position to be taking pot shots at other journalists."
Oh my goodness. Journalism drama.
I just wanted to share that because it's so funny.
Like, journalism drama is, it's coming with, you know, the finesse of people who know how to write.
So, right? You know, like, I mean? And I mean, imagine like, and this plagiarism thing was way back in 2014, I think. Like imagine doing that and then just waiting on Twitter for 8 years being like, "Have people forgotten yet? Like, can I make fun of other journalists again?" Like, that's,
maybe try not making fun of people first, and when you rebuild your reputation, and then you can make fun of other people.
Yeah. Anyway, I just thought that was funny.
Yeah. So he completely missed that Nadal made other finals after 2009. Is that what it is? Like, he just completely screwed up.
Yeah. Stats. Like, he said, he didn't even think he had made a semifinal since 2009. It was just a stats mistake, and like, it's a very bad stats mistake. But it's like, he had a long week, so
yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
That's gotta be rough. Like, when you say that to Nadal.
Yeah, I mean, Riley Opelka is saying like someone, he should either try harder or like someone else should have this position. It's like, is he not allowed to make one mistake? Like, comparison I thought of is like, dude, you've double faulted in big matches. Doesn't mean you're a bad server. Like,
yeah, these guys are working hard and traveling, like, you know, on economy, big travels, like long travels, probably jet lagged. And you know what I mean? Like, he made one mistake, I guess. It's a big mistake, and he's probably gonna hear from that one later, but like, it's still like, he's gonna keep his job, like, and he's gonna do better,
right?
And, you know, sometimes you misspeak or you misphrase things. Even Rafa, and his response was like,
it said 2018 instead of 2019,
2019. So, you know, and you know, people forget years and things like that.
Yeah, Vansh, I was so glad you pointed that out on Twitter, because I read that and I was like, he's also wrong, but no one's going to be talking about that.
Like, we're just human after all, even though some are much more talented than others.
But... Yeah, all of us are human, but some are more human than others. But yeah, I mean, at some point I want to ask Opelka, like, what was written about you that made you hate tennis media? Because like, I'm not saying he's wrong to feel this way, but like, I want to know what it was that like started the hate.
Next time you get a credential, you can ask him that.
Yeah.
All right, I guess we covered everything tennis-wise, and you know, there was a lot of things to talk about that were not about Djokovic got caught in immigration problems in Australia. So makes me happy that tennis is happening.
Yeah. So now I'm gonna go like chill for 3 hours until the draw and or the decision come out, and
exactly
the world explodes again.
Yeah.
Yep. And we'll be back with all the action when the draws come out, right? And we'll.
Yeah.
Are we doing this? When are we doing a draw preview?
We'll see. Whenever I finish this podcast, we can talk about
it. Sweet. Yeah.
Yes. All right.
Glad our listeners know how like structurally good we are with planning. Like,
yeah.
We've got you covered.
When we get more than 1,000 listeners per episode, we're definitely going to structure ourselves. Like, so share this podcast with everyone that you know if you want us to get more structured.
Yeah,
I mean, 1,000 plays per episode.
Even share it with the people you don't know. If you're just walking down the street past someone random, like, say,
do you like bagels? Do you like tennis?
Yeah. Stop them and say, hey, you need to listen to this podcast. Yeah. And then maybe we can hit 1,000. So get on it, please.
Yeah. Anyway, thanks, guys, for showing up. It was a great discussion. It was great talking about tennis, actual on-court tennis this time. Vanche is at VancheVTK, Owen's at Tennis Nation, and I am at Rothenberg Andre on Twitter. Tennis and Bagels at Tennis and Bagels. Couldn't be easier. We are going through a little bit of a transition process from Anchor to Acast. If you don't know what it is, it pretty much means that it might not be available on all the platforms for a couple days, but I'll be working on fixing that very, very soon. Thanks for your support. Thanks for listening, and see you later. Bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.